ya bilanga mozi mani bako mani mabuku mani katimu mamu babide kusala nere to another edition of Congo Vision Radio. Actually, welcome to the first edition of Congo Vision Radio for 2009. Our guest today is Mr. Milton Alimadi, publisher and CEO of the Black Stars News. The Black Star News is an online newspaper that's been publishing a lot of stories about the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mr. Alimadi, I'd like to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about the Black Star News?
Well, I was born in Uganda.
Oh.
I've lived most of my life away from Uganda.
Uh-huh.
Even though I did go to primary school, most of my primary school education was in Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
And then my secondary school education was in Tanzania.
Mm-hmm.
My father was involved in politics. So when Idi Amin seized control in 1971, my family lived in Tanzania in exile.
Mm-hmm.
And then after secondary school in Tanzania is when I came to the United States. I went to Syracuse University for college.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked for a few years. And then I went back to school to study journalism at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with a number of publications. I actually did my first internship at the Wall Street Journal. And then I worked at the New York Times in Metro News reporting, that's City News.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked for a weekly paper called The City Sun, which was an African-American-oriented publication here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few years later, in 1997, is when I launched the Black Star News. It is a weekly paper on newsstands, and then, of course, you had already mentioned the website, which is blackstarnews.com.
Oh, great. Well, you've been writing a lot of stories for the Democratic Republic of Congo and against Uganda, your own country. How do you explain that?
Well, it's not so much against Uganda, but it's against policies that are detrimental, not only for Uganda, but to the entire East and Central African region. And that policy has always been to promote armed conflict and militarism as solution to political problems. And I think that has now spilled into other countries in the region. It's not confined to Uganda alone. It's now in Rwanda, it's in Eastern Congo, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
It's now in the Garamba region of the Congo as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all interlocked. And unfortunately, this policy has been supported by the United States as well, because the Ugandan regime has been serving the same role that Mobutu used to in the 1960s and the 1970s on behalf of the United States, which is to act as the regional policeman. For example, Uganda was the only country, apart from Ethiopia, which agreed to send troops to Somalia on behalf of the United States intervention, a policy which is now collapsing, and the Islamist, which the United States wanted to remove and used Ethiopia and Uganda to remove, are now back in control in Somalia.
Okay.
It's a very short-sighted policy, and African civilians suffer the consequences.
So what are your thoughts about the war that's going on in DRC?
It's not very different from the second invasion of the Congo. As we know, the first invasion of 1996 to 1997 got rid of Mobutu. And Mobutu was widely detested. He was very destructive. He destroyed what was then Zaire. So the removal of popular all over Africa and in many regions of the world. But then when Mobutu's successor, Laurent Kabila, started expressing his own policies, which were divergent to his sponsors, and of course the people that sponsored him at the time was Uganda, Rwanda, and to some extent the United States, who had also gotten tired of Mobutu. But when he started exercising independence, that's when they tried to remove him. And the second invasion of the Congo resulted in wars of genocide and occupation of eastern Congo and the illegal extraction of resources from the Congo. In 2005, the International Court of Justice found Uganda liable for war crimes in the Congo and for illegal looting of resources and assessed $10 billion liability against the Ugandan government.
Which Uganda hasn't paid yet.
No, Uganda has not paid. But, on the other hand, I'm surprised that the Congo has not moved to exercise liens against Ugandan assets outside Uganda, including its embassy buildings around the world.
So, what do you think is the root cause of the conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo?
I think it's primarily over resources. I think, as a UN report found out, I believe that same report was also in 2005, that many Western companies, and in fact these companies were listed in the UN report, were illegally benefiting by extracting timber, coltan, gold, and other resources from eastern Congo without having to pay taxes to the central government. Uganda and Rwanda, countries that do not produce gold, started exporting significant quantities of gold.
Mm-hmm.
And the UN documented how these resources were being stolen from the Congo. And it named top political and military leadership in both countries, in Uganda and Rwanda, as beneficiaries of this illegal extraction of resources, including the family of the president of Uganda, primarily through his brother, who is also a general in the army, and his name is General Salim Saleh. But in addition to the ICJ finding Uganda liable in 2005, the ICC, which investigates the criminal aspect, also launched an investigation of the same crimes on which the ICJ had found Uganda liable. And according to an article on June 8, 2006 in the Wall Street Journal, the president of Uganda himself called then UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and urged him to block the investigation because he knows that potentially either he himself or his top commanders could be indicted by the ICC, as was the case with the president of the Sudan, al-Bashir, who was indicted a few months ago by the ICC on crimes committed in the Darfur region in the Sudan.
One of the consequences of the illegal exploitation of minerals in DRC is the genocide that's taking place in that country. There is great silence about that genocide. What can be done to break the silence?
Well, first of all, I believe that Congolese citizens in this country should form alliances with certain organizations and make their opposition known. But you have to be vocal. You have to, as you know how politics work in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be seen demonstrating.
Mm-hmm.
You have to protest. You have to petition. Send petitions to the incoming Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. Send and petitions to the incoming president, president-elect, Barack Obama. But you have to be seen visibly protesting. You have to find a way to get it in media.
And what if the media doesn't want to play along? Because there is a sense that the media doesn't want to put the stories, those stories of genocide out there.
No, but it can be done. Because let me ask you a question. How many times have you individually or as a group challenged the editors at major newspapers, such as the New York Times?
I've done it many times myself. I've done it for CNN, NPR, and the New York Times, Fox News, all the major TV networks in the U.S.
How many times have you organized demonstrations in front of their offices?
Probably.
There you go.
Okay.
These are the kind of things you have to do. You have to shame them.
Uh-huh.
They're not going to do it out of the goodness of their heart.
Uh-huh.
Because let's face it, the New York Times is a corporate publication.
Uh-huh.
It's a company, just like any other corporation, with shareholders. And in fact, if you do your research, you'll find out that some of the companies that were named as beneficiaries of the illegal extraction of resources from the Congo
uh-huh.
are probably companies that do business with the New York Times as well
uh-huh.
and all the other major corporate-owned newspapers and media outlets in this country.
Uh-huh.
So that's why, in fact, it is much easier for an independent media outlet, such as the Black Star News, to publish these critical articles. And I've also engaged the New York Times for years, as you have.
Uh-huh.
But you have to find creative ways of doing it. You have to let them know
uh-huh.
that you're shaming them and exposing them.
Isn't there a racial component to this, to the conflict? Because if there is a genocide occurring in Europe, for instance, the magazines, the networks, the journals, the newspapers, they don't. Nobody needs to convince them. They just go out there and write stories. Why should people convince them first that what is going on there, what is going on in the Congo is not okay, that's not justice, we should do something.
Yeah, but we know that. We have to take that for granted when it comes to the racial aspect.
Uh-huh.
We know that. That is why crimes of genocide have been tolerated in African countries for a long time. When Idi Amin was decimating the population in Uganda, the West did not care. For many years, Idi Amin was okay for them because he had gotten rid of Milton Obote, who had started moving toward policies of socialism in Uganda. So, of course, they saw him as a threat to their assets. So they promoted this guy whom they thought was some buffoon whom they could manipulate. And they didn't really care that in the process he killed hundreds of thousands of innocent Ugandans. It was only when he started aligning himself very closely to the Arab Muslim countries and started denouncing the West and started being very critical towards Israel, that is only when they started becoming critical towards his murderous regime. So we know how the system works. It is not going to be the body count alone, because look at it this way. Why is Darfur so much more in the news than is the Congo?
Uh-huh.
Where by their own estimates, anywhere from 5 to 7 million people have been killed.
Uh-huh.
So we know uh-huh. about this disparate way of reporting, because it does not really harm their interest that much. So if we leave it to that, nothing will be accomplished, and the killings will continue.
What should Africans expect from President Obama administration?
This is how I see it. I think you can only get as much out of it as you demand and as you force them to do. If we go by the philosophy that people will always do the right thing, we'll always be the losers in this kind of equation. Because global politics does not not operate in that manner. That is why I'm quite serious when I say that there has to be protest, mass protests and demonstrations. There are a lot of people that have become conscious of the atrocities in the Congo now, particularly because of the use of rape, mass rape, as a weapon during this genocidal warfare. So now there are many organizations, even here in the United States, particularly women's organizations. Those are the kind of groups that you need to form alliances with and explain to them what is involved in terms of the background of this war. Who are the players, the ones we see and the unseen players? Who's financing these wars? And if you get them involved, believe me, they know how to get media's attention in this country.
The United Nations recent report on the conflict in the Congo accuses Rwanda of helping the rebels in DRC. Why isn't the UN taking any measures or sanctions against Rwanda?
That is the question that you need to use during the demonstrations outside the UN, outside the Rwanda consulate, outside the Uganda consulate, outside the United States mission to the UN. All the evidence, all the ingredients for very effective protests and demonstration are out there. They just need to be well coordinated now.
So much harm has been done to the people of the Congo by Rwanda, Uganda, and to a lesser extent, Burundi. What do you think is the best way for these countries to repair the images in the region?
Well, obviously, by the mere fact that they presided over those kind of actions, those genocidal wars, indicates that they're not suitable to be in leadership positions in those countries. And that brings us to the other thing. For such a long time, for as long as Mobutu served the interests of the United States, they sustained him. They maintained them. They even financed Morocco to send armed intervention a few times when it looked like his regime might collapse. So it's the whole hypocrisy. They talk about democracy and accountable governance and how that should be promoted in African countries. But when it comes up to the reality, it's just a farce. It's pure hypocrisy. So long as the regime serves their interests, they would do anything to sustain that type of leadership, even to the detriment of the domestic population in those countries.
In a recent article, you said that the New York Times is changing its tone about the conflict in DRC. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, I believe they are, because this is the first time that they gave major play to a UN report accusing the government of Rwanda of financing this current turmoil and genocidal killings in eastern Congo. And I say this is new because this is not the first time that the UN has issued such a report. The UN report of I think it was 2005, which detailed the companies that were benefiting from the killings in eastern Congo and the illegal extraction of resources. That report did not get the kind of play that this report got. And as you notice, most media outlets in the United States take their cue from the New York Times. So if the New York Times plays something as a big story, they also would play it as a big story. So I'm seeing some changes.
And the New York Times just published an article by Herman Cohen, the former undersecretary, the former U.S. Undersecretary of State for Africa. And Cohen has this very strange proposal for peace in the region. His proposal states that there needs to be a framework for an economic common market encompassing Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda. And the agreement would allow the free movement of people and trade, and it would give Rwanda businesses continued access to Congolese minerals and forests, and the products made from those raw materials would continue to be exported through Rwanda. A big change would be the payment of royalties and taxes to the Congolese government. I mean, as a Congolese, this is a huge insult. What's your understanding of this?
Well, the end result, to have a common East African and Central African market, that in itself is not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's the only thing he's saying. I think what he's saying is he's trying to make the to have the de facto occupation of Eastern Congo, to have it recognized officially.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm reading in between the lines.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing it in a very clever way.
Mm-hmm.
He's for the first time openly saying that indeed it's true that Rwanda is financing the occupation and the atrocities there. So he's conceding to that.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying Congo has the right to exercise sovereignty over all this territory. So he's also conceding to that. What he's not addressing is the fact that, for example, in the case of Laurent Nkunda,
mm-hmm.
his chief of staff has already been indicted by the ICC.
Mm-hmm.
He's not saying that since Rwanda has control over Nkunda's forces,
mm-hmm.
they should facilitate the capture of the chief of staff and his delivery to The Hague, to the ICC.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot have the chief of staff of an army indicted without indicting the commander. And even the New York Times has recently started writing about something that we wrote about more than a month ago,
mm-hmm.
which is that Nkunda will not be able to escape indictment and would probably also end up in the Hague. So it's fine to talk about formation of these regional markets. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is we have to address the immediate emergency on the ground, which is that the killings must end, people must be allowed to return back to their homes, to rebuild their homes, to start farming so that they can grow their own food, as they've been doing for years, without having to rely on United Nations and foreign food release, which is, of course, very humiliating to people that have been always independent, to have to end up living in mass refugee camps. So these are the immediate issues of the day. The issues of the common market, that can be addressed at a later stage. Right now, crimes of genocide are being committed. It has to end. And that should have been the topic of his op-ed piece in the New York Times.
And the U.S. being the only superpower today, why do you think it's not exerting its moral leadership to try to end the genocide in the Congo?
Because we have one of the most corrupt regimes in Washington. Some of the top players have benefited from the war in Iraq. They really didn't care about the death toll, whether it was the death toll of the U.S. forces, the United States Army, American soldiers. Regardless, they didn't care about that. So you can't even imagine that the disdain they must have for Iraqi lives, the loss of the lives of Iraqi citizens. So they were profiting from that. Equally, they're profiting from the situation in Eastern Congo. This is a regime that does not care. I call it the Bush regime. Does not care about the level of human suffering. So long as the key players, some of the most corrupt individuals, benefit financially from it. So that is the reason why, obviously, they don't see it as a great atrocity in Eastern Congo.
Do you think things will be different with Obama and Hillary Clinton?
I think unless people do the work that they need to do, things would not be significantly different. Because corporations, to a great extent, will continue running this country.
Mm-hmm.
So that all the approaches that I outlined earlier would still apply, even with the new government in Washington.
1994.
The demonstrations, the petitions, forming alliances with all these organizations, like the women's groups that are outraged about the use of mass rapes as a weapon. These are the kind of significant alliances that need to be formed. Look, Darfur was not in the news until just a few years ago, when the Save Darfur movement emerged, and they were able to mobilize national attention in schools and churches with labor organizations and get all the radio and television and newspaper advertising.
What can the Congo...
an issue, and I think the Congo can do the same thing.
Okay. What can we learn from that?
I think the great lesson here is that the body counts really don't matter. Because in the case of the Congo, by their own estimates, as I said earlier, anywhere from 5 to 7 million dead. And I'm not saying that the atrocities in the Darfur region should be diminished. But certainly nobody has, that I've read anywhere, has mentioned a figure of more than 300 to 400,000, which is, of course, still a great tragedy. But the question then that has to be raised is why the different type of coverage and exposure and outrage. And that is when these type of organizations and mobilization that I spoke about come into play.
In 1994, the international community stood by as thousands of people were slaughtered in Rwanda. And they all vowed, the international community, I mean, vowed that they will never allowed this kind of genocide or a genocide of that magnitude to occur again. It said never again. And here is a genocide occurring again in the Congo, and the international community is not doing anything. I can't even put words. I can't even explain this. How do you explain this?
Well, as I said, if you look at, let's take 1994 as an example, first of all. There are a number of reasons why it was not in the United States' interest to really intervene. Because intervention would have meant halting the march by the RPF, the Rwanda Patriotic Front, which was on its way to seizing power. We have to realize that the United States was intimately involved in the invasion of Rwanda in 1990. The United States was determined for the French influence in the region to be displaced. The leader of the RPF, Paul Kagame, who is the president today, was sent here for training at Fort Leavenworth on a Ugandan passport because he had been the chief of Uganda military intelligence. And after the first commander of the RPF was killed on October 1, 1990, Kagame left his training here in the United States and went back and took command of the RPF. The United States knew all this because the United States was training the top leadership of the RPF. The United States knew that genocide was already occurring in the form of massacres in the region which had already been seized by the combined armies of the RPF and Uganda. And nothing was done, which to me is a clear indication that the United States had no interest in a negotiated solution to the Rwanda conflict and was backing the RPF all the way to seize total control without asking the question, how is an army made exclusively of a small portion of the population going to be able to hold power in Rwanda? So that dangerous equation was disregarded until, of course, the two presidents, one of Rwanda and the president of Burundi, were killed in that yet up to date unresolved attack with the missiles. and then the genocide erupted. So the United States, as far as I'm concerned, bears actually more than moral responsibility for what happened in Rwanda. So I was not surprised that the U.S. was not interested in sending an intervention force to try to prevent the genocide there, because the primary U.S. agenda at that point was to displace the French-dominated leadership in Rwanda. And it backfired with the genocide.
Now, the same people who were victims of genocide in Rwanda, they are today committing a genocide in the Congo, a genocide of a bigger scale. Many people in the Democratic Republic of Congo are beginning to feel, to have mixed feelings about about the Tutsis.
Well, you know, that's unfortunate, because it's not fair, and it's very dangerous to lump entire ethnic population and say that, you know, they're responsible for the ongoing genocide in eastern Congo, just as it was...
It's the leadership, though.
I understand, the leadership, yes, that's accurate. Just as it was completely unfair to lump all the Hutus in Rwanda as being responsible for the massacre of Tutsis. Because obviously in a country where 85% of the population are made out of Hutu, not all of them could have participated in the genocide. So it's very unfair to, like, you know, give them that criminal connotation. That's why I also don't think it's right for people to give all Tutsis criminal connotation and say they're responsible for the genocide in eastern Congo. That's not, it's not fair, and it's not correct, and it's very dangerous. But what is clear is that Laurent Nkunda and his criminal army is involved in the genocide, and that he indeed is being sponsored and financed by Rwanda. But having said that, it should not criminalize all Tutsis, the vast majority, or who are playing no role at all in these atrocities.
Then why don't they stand up and oppose their government, or just denounce what's going on in the Congo?
But that has always been the problem in African countries. It's always been the problem in African countries, because we allow our leadership to play one ethnic community against the other. We have a situation in Uganda right now where the leader comes from the Ankole region. And in Uganda, in fact, many Ugandans seriously believe that he may in fact be from Rwanda, or at least traces his ethnic heritage from there. So now he's polarized the politics in the country. The top political leadership, the people that he can appoint, come from his region. People that are commanding the army come from his region. So those are the kind of things that can start generating enmity toward people from his region, when in fact the vast majority of the people from his region would not want to be a part of this, you see? Because if we keep thinking about politics of revenge, no African country will ever be able to move forward. I think the Nigerians did a, to a great extent, a relatively great thing after the Biafra Civil War. The war itself was, of course, brutal. Many Igbos were massacred. But I think when the war ended, they really tried seriously to embark on a policy of reconciliation. And I don't think they had an agenda of continuing with massacres of Igbos. Otherwise, Nigeria would not have survived at all.
What do you see as the biggest challenge facing the Democratic Republic of Congo today?
I think, first of all, the Congo needs to secure its territory. Because if you cannot secure your territory, you cannot embark in nation building. The Congo has vast resources, but the Congo needs outside capital to tap its resources, to develop the infrastructure necessary to exploit the mineral resources. But you're not going to have capital coming in when it's not clear who really has physical control over the territory. So that's the biggest challenge, to the Congo right now.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think the Congo has a great opportunity. I think the current government, with all its faults and limitations, is recognized as the legitimate government in the Congo. I think when the decision was made to have Jean-Pierre Bemba arrested,
mm-hmm.
I think that was also a statement that they wanted to remove the most destabilizing agent
mm-hmm.
in Congo
mm-hmm.
and take him to The Hague.
Mm-hmm.
So if I read those kind of signals carefully,
mm-hmm.
it suggests to me that if the Congo can do its homework,
mm-hmm.
it can actually get the kind of support that it needs in the Western countries. I think, obviously, Kabila is going to need a lot of support, but the first challenge he has is to be able to secure all the territory of the Congo.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there are many places in the world right now
mm-hmm.
where you have a UN intervention force
mm-hmm.
of 17,000 trying to stabilize the situation. Obviously, they've not done, they can actually do a better work than what they've been doing so far.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've been lax. I think one of the key things that the UN force there should try to do is to create a buffer zone between Uganda and Congo and between Rwanda and Congo and secure the borders, because the destabilizing forces are coming from outside and they're being financed from outside.
Mm-hmm. Spain has an outstanding arrest warrant against Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, and some Rwandan army officers. French also has an outstanding arrest warrant. Shouldn't that maybe make those people act a little bit differently?
Well,
or deter them from committing crimes in the Congo?
That's a very good question. But then sometimes when you think that those arrest warrants will never be exercised,
mm-hmm.
then you know it becomes like a moot point.
Not when they leave power.
But you know what?
We don't know what's going to happen when they leave power.
Well, not only that. As we know, presidents can be indicted
mm-hmm.
when they're still sitting president. And as I said, we see the case with the president of the Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
But the key thing is these things don't happen in a vacuum. For the ICC to indict a sitting president, but, you know, obviously the signal must come from somewhere. They're all tied in together. Securing Congolese territory,
mm-hmm.
Exposing media
mm-hmm.
that ought to know better but are not reporting the news, forming those alliances with groups that can help mobilize and sway public opinion in the United States. Particularly the women's group. Those are very critical things that all need to come together.
Mm-hmm. With its constant invasions of DRC, Rwanda must be afraid of a strong national army, army in the Congo, don't you think?
Absolutely, without a doubt, of course. But that's the wrong thinking, because for them to think that our survival is only based on having a perpetually weak and disorganized Congo, that's not the right way of thinking. That's very short-sighted, because ultimately the situation will improve in the Congo. As I said, my reading of the ongoing coverage, the most recent coverage, at least in the New York Times, suggests that things are moving in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And that perhaps, this is my hope, that people have really had enough of these mass killings, and that we will move towards ending it once and for all in Central Africa.
In closing, how do you see the future of the region? What do you predict is going to happen in the near future?
I think I'm very hopeful. And, you know, I have great hope in the younger generation, younger Africans that have different experiences, their different backgrounds, different ways of communicating and exchanging information with young people all over the world. They don't come with the type of burden and the prejudices that maybe our generation and the generation before did. So I think there's a possibility that they would have less of this ethnic enmity, very short-sighted considerations. So I think that the future holds great promises, because certainly the region and much of the continent, as we know, is endowed with the resources that we need for national development. We just have to get the political act together, and I see that happening in the future.
Mr. Milton Arimadi, thank you very much for joining us. I'd like to remind our listeners that you are a publisher and CEO of the Black Star News.
Yes, the Black Star News, and our website is blackstarnews.com.
Thank you.
And we also welcome any submissions from your audience and from the readers.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And you can send it to editor at Black Star News.
Thank you very much.